You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when it comes to understanding Foxconn in Wisconsin, there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle. We'll look at the major players involved in the deal and the geopolitics behind it all. First, women's basketball has a long history here in Wisconsin, going all the way back to the earliest years of the sport in the 1890s. At the University of Wisconsin, women's teams were the first to tip off 4 years before the men started playing. The women's program was a campus fan favorite and introduced one especially memorable mascot. Tim Brady is a freelance writer and a graduate of UW-Madison. His recent piece for On Wisconsin magazine is called The Women and the Goat. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Wisconsin women, you write, Tim, were early in the game. In 1894, just a few years after basketball was invented, women were the first ones on the UW campus to start playing. Can you give us a sense of what those games were like?
Well, they were pretty slow affairs, I would say. I've looked at some online footage of early women's basketball, and it was kind of a static kind of game. Played a lot above the shoulder. There was no dribbling. There was little foot movement, and it was at least at the start crowded with players.
Yeah, nine on a side, you wrote.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about how this became a fan favorite. This was a big sport. The students were really into it, right? Women's basketball in the early days in Wisconsin.
They were. It became the game was restricted. There was no intercollegiate competition. It was prohibited by the powers that be, thinking that that it was just unseemly for women to be playing spectator sports and traveling for games. So it was pretty much left as a kind of intramural affair on the campus, and it was played between classes, and the competition between classes sort of enhanced the competitive flavor of the game.
Nowadays, when we hear the word GOAT related to basketball, it stands for greatest of all time. Tell us about the GOAT, though, that became a big part of women's basketball at UW over 100 years ago.
Well, there was one particular year. There was a competitiveness between the sophomores and the seniors, and the sophomores had a good squad, but the seniors were slightly better. But to throw them off the game just prior to the opening tip-off, the sophomores paraded out onto the floor of Lathrop Hall with a goat. And I was trying to look around for why they would choose a goat, and the closest I could get to a story was the fact that the phrase "to get your goat" had become current about that time, and it related to some obscure practices around horse racing tracks where goats were seen as a means to calm down thoroughbred racehorses, and one practice that was taken place at that time was for one trainer to steal another's goat, and the phrase "to get your goat" became synonymous with to bother you or to upset your game. So that's about as close as I can get to why the goat.
And later, the live goat was replaced with a stuffed animal goat, it sounds like, and there were some real shenanigans surrounding attempted thefts of this stuffed goat between the women's classes and their teams.
Yeah, well, the initial goat, the original goat, became a sort of legendary story on campus, as in, you remember when the sophomores brought the goat to that game, and it in about 10 years after it first appeared, another interclass game was begun with I think it again it was the sophomore class bringing, they didn't bring a live goat this time, but they brought a stuffed goat to the game, and that stuffed goat afterward became was passed from one winning team to the next, and it became sort of a symbol of the championship interclass league that had developed at the campus.
We'll leave it there for now, Tim. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
That's Tim Brady, freelance writer and UW grad. He was with us to talk about the origins of women's basketball at the University of Wisconsin, going all the way back to the 1890s. Today, the sport is still going strong in Wisconsin, thanks in part to a new professional women's team, the Wisconsin Glow. The team is playing in its first season based at the Menominee Nation Arena in Oshkosh. So far, they are undefeated. Allie LeClaire is a player for the Glow. She's also from Green Bay and the seventh leading all-time scorer at UW-Green Bay. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's it like for you being in on the ground floor of this new basketball league?
Oh, it's awesome. I love it. You know, we just had our recent game last weekend. So I think last weekend we had, you know, one of the number one draft picks of 2005. And it's just cool, I think, just getting to know the girls and just seeing how much talent that we have here in Wisconsin. So far, it's been such an amazing time, and definitely loving basketball right now.
I was looking through the roster. There's a lot of Wisconsin talent here, either women from Wisconsin and or playing for a college team, or, as in your case, both. So a lot of hometown spirit here.
Yeah, I know, for sure. I think that's the coolest part is, you know, some of these girls we grew up watching play, we played against. Obviously, I played with Jess and Marin, but like I said, I think that's just the coolest part is, you know, watching these girls and then, you know, you never thought you'd be able to play with them. So just kind of learning from them and, you know, seeing what each of us can bring to the team every single night. So it's been fun. And, you know, hopefully in the years to come, we get some more talent and just new girls coming in and hopefully expand the game of basketball in Wisconsin.
And did I see you also played a season professionally in Ireland just before this?
Yeah, so I actually got back from Ireland mid-April. So I was there since last August. So I felt like I was there for a while. So that was such a good experience. Obviously, it sucks if you miss home and miss your teammates and things, but I think that's the coolest part is just coming back for the Glow. And, you know, you feel a little re-energized a little bit just playing in front of friends and family again. So, you know, it's a great experience. And, you know, I definitely don't want to take it for granted.
Your team is doing well. I think I saw 5-0. You've had some convincing wins, instead of including a 90-something to 30-something over a Chicago team. Team's doing pretty well so far, it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Everyone comes to the games and they're like, are you ever going to have a closer game? Like, some people make comments like that, but I just think it shows the depth of our roster and the talent that we have. Like I said, I don't think you're going to find that necessarily anywhere else. So it's been fun. Obviously, you fans might want it to be a closer game, but you can't complain about winning, right? So, you know, hopefully there'll be some closer games and, you know, some excitement for the fans. But I think they're just like, it's, you know, the talent that we have on the roster.
What do you think about this as an expanded opportunity for women to go on and play after college, play professionally?
I think it's a great opportunity. I think, you know, for women especially, just kind of getting our name out there and having people come and watch us. Obviously, we're not dunking or any of the crazy things that some guys can do, but I think we bring other aspects to the game, and I think if that people learn just more about us as individuals and how that correlates to the basketball floor, I think that, you know, it's a great opportunity. So hopefully down the road, you know, WNBA teams or more professional teams kind of learn more about us and see what we're about. So, you know, more girls are able to kind of go overseas and play professionally or in the WNBA.
What's the response been from fans in Oshkosh and the Fox Cities area?
I think everyone likes it, honestly. Like, after talking to, like, a lot of people after the game, you know, they play music at the game. They get the fans interacted. So I think that it's good so far, but I think the biggest thing is just getting more fans there and telling people about it. So, you know, as most as we can put it on social media and tell people, I think, you know, just getting to that first game and seeing what's it about. And, you know, I've seen and heard people, they come for one game and they already have plans to come to the next one. So, I've heard good things. You know, the Glow, they spoil us. We feel spoiled when we go there and then we go on the road and things aren't necessarily the same. So they've done a great job so far with treating us, you know, kind of like the herd. Like they said, they want it to be an experience just like the men. So they've done a great job so far, and, you know, we're all really happy with it.
As we heard from our last guest, in the early days of basketball, it was 9-on-9, 9 players on a side. Can you imagine playing with a court that crowded?
No, not at all. I have no idea, like, how you would even function. I feel like, yeah, that's bizarre. I think that's cool, though, just to see how it's grown and, you know, how big basketball is these days and, you know, how it hopefully continues to grow.
Well, good luck in the season. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's Allie LeClaire, a player for the Wisconsin Glow, the professional women's basketball team now in its first ever season. Their next game is this Sunday at 3:00 at the Menominee Nation Arena in Oshkosh. Coming up, our guest looks at the tangled web of international business and political relationships at play when it comes to Foxconn and how Wisconsin factors into it all. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump says a deal with Mexico is a big victory on the immigration front. There's some confusion, though, about what it actually involves. We'll find out what we know in just a bit. First, when it comes to understanding Foxconn and the company's plans to set up shop here in Wisconsin, it can be confusing to say the least. There are multiple countries involved with complicated histories and some powerful business and political leaders, all with their own interests. Our next guest is here to break down the major players involved and the geopolitics behind it all. Willie Shee is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. His recent piece for WisContext is headlined Foxconn, Terry Go, Donald Trump, Taiwan, and China. It's really complicated. Willie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to join you.
Well, it's a complicated web. Let's start with the relationship between Taiwan and China, adversaries in some ways, incredibly close business partners in others. Untangle that for us.
Well, it is very complicated. You know, there's a long history of Taiwan and China. Of course, Taiwan was where the Kuomintang retreated when they lost control of the mainland to the Chinese Communist Party, right? So the mainland government views Taiwan as a rebellious province, and I think most of the people in Taiwan would take issue with that, right? So you have that historical context. Now, the next thing that is interesting, to me anyways, is you have to remember much of Taiwan, when the Kuomintang moved to Taiwan, they brought a lot of the mainland culture, right? So when China opened up in the 1990s, it was Taiwanese companies that actually took the lead in really industrialization and development of China. They introduced a lot of this model of this huge campus with tens of thousands of people doing manual assembly work. And it was companies like Foxconn and others from Taiwan that really led this charge into Chinese manufacturing, especially for the electronics industry. So they leveraged that kind of common cultural heritage, common language, understanding of, how to do business in China. So that makes it a very complicated picture.
And introduce us to this character who spent some time now in Wisconsin, Terry Go, chair and president of Foxconn, running for normal kind of president of Taiwan, but a revered figure in some ways in communist China, if we want to still call it communist China, mainland China, I should say. Tell us how he fits in on both sides of that equation.
Well, Terry Go is the founder of Foxconn, which was a very small company initially, but he and Foxconn were one of the pioneers in this model of building these large factory complexes in China. Now, initially, they manufactured a lot of different electronic products for people, okay, but their growth really got supercharged when they managed to start doing some business with Apple, right? So Foxconn grew dramatically with Apple, in particular with the growth of the iPhone, because for many years, Foxconn was the exclusive assembler of iPhones for Apple. And so what you found is that as the iPhone grew, Foxconn grew as well. In fact, they set up enormous campuses with hundreds of thousands of people. And Foxconn soon became the largest private employer in China. So imagine that now. You have Terry Go, Taiwanese entrepreneur, Taiwan-based company, largest employer in China. And if you're the largest employer in China, that makes you pretty important not only to the local governments where you operate, but also to the Chinese Communist Party.
We've got Taiwan. We've got China. Okay, why would Foxconn want to open a big factory here in Wisconsin?
Well, this is where it really gets complicated. Okay, and, after Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, Terry Go was actually one of the first foreign business leaders to meet with him. Okay, and Foxconn is relatively high profile because of their relationship supplying Apple, right? And, we've seen it in the press. Donald Trump recommended to Terry Go that you should put a factory in Wisconsin, right? And that led to this big project down in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, that initially was supposed to be a big factory for making these LCD flat panel displays, right? So all of a sudden, you have this, we're going to bring jobs back to America, Terry Guo being on the front lines of that. Now, that was really before the trade war heated up as it has in the last few weeks and last few months. Okay, so that's been really quite a dynamic and interesting situation on its own rights.
And something people here in Wisconsin are watching is, what is this factory actually going to make? It was one kind of flat screen, then a different, a smaller screen. Now, just this week, we're hearing from the company, maybe it's not screens at all. It's servers, car parts, that kind of thing. So what?
Well, that's one of those evolving stories, as you say. Okay, when Foxconn first committed to putting the factory there, the original vision was to build what was called a Generation 10.5 or Gen 10.5 LCD factory. And this would be one of these factories that makes very large screen TVs. In fact, Gen 10.5 is the largest size glass that you can make a TV on. That's equivalent to making 6 75-inch TVs at a time on one giant piece of glass, which you then cut into separate pieces. Now, that was the original vision that they sold to the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, the state of Wisconsin looks at it and it's like, well, there aren't a lot of these factories in the world, right? There are less than a dozen of them. There's some in Japan. There's some in China. There's some in Korea. But there aren't that many, right? So the original promise is, well, we're going to bring high-tech manufacturing to Wisconsin. But it turns out that, you know, the state gave Foxconn a heavy subsidy to build this factory, but the state didn't give Foxconn suppliers subsidies to build their factories, which you need to feed this LCD factory. So Foxconn has been scaling back its ambitions because if it didn't have a glass supplier across the street, which would be somebody like Corning, then they can't build a factory there because it's not practical to ship some of the raw materials. So they've been shifting, and there's been a lot of debate on what's actually going to go in there. If you look at the most recent plan filings, it looks like they're going to do some kind of electronic assembly. They're going to build a large building. They're making progress on that. That actually happens to fit in very well with the current state of this trade war, right? Because especially in the last few weeks, what you've seen is many companies saying, oh boy, I can't manufacture in China anymore. I have to go somewhere else. And that somewhere else is largely going to be Vietnam, Malaysia. Maybe some will go to Indonesia. Some will go to the Philippines. I think a lot will go to Mexico. Okay, but now you have this building in Mount Pleasant that isn't going to be a Gen 10.5 factory anymore. Okay, it's going to be electronic assembly. And, you know, so if they're talking about car parts or, you know, maybe TV sets or medical equipment or something like that, that would all make sense. Okay, I would be fairly confident that wasn't their vision when they announced this project. But, you know, as the winds change, they're kind of adjusting that vision and trying to fit it into something that they can sell to the local population.
Talking to Willie Shi from Harvard Business School about Foxconn and where it fits in the world, not just in Wisconsin. I want to bring up a concept you introduced in your WisContext piece, something from Chinese politics and economy, a state visit project. What is that?
Right. Well, and this happens in China a lot. Okay, what happens is all the big guys, cook up some deal like, oh, we should put a factory here, right? And there's all this prestige and so on. So then they stage a big announcement and, you know, a ribbon cutting and, you know, they'll have the gold-plated shovels, you know, shovel the first scoop of dirt and so on like that. And this happens all the time. There's the big announcement. Okay, but then what actually gets delivered may or may not match that, right? But the announcement is there for political reasons, right? Because one or both sides see some political benefits associated with that. And it's also a way of getting both sides to commit to doing something. Okay, now in China, what happens is a lot of those projects don't pan out. They never turn into something. A lot of them turn into something that was quite different from what was announced. And that's kind of an accepted part of the practice. That's not how we play the game in the United States, right? It's like, wait a minute, I thought we signed an agreement on this, and I thought I was going to give you all this subsidy, right? So there's kind of a cultural mismatch in that. But these state visit projects are when, you know, think of it as when the big guys get together, they announce this big deal, you get the big publicity splash, and then everybody goes on and figures out, what are we really going to do here?
Willie, in just our last minute, what happens if Terry Goh of Foxconn becomes Terry Goh, president of Taiwan?
Well, that's what makes this really complicated, because Terry has to leave Foxconn if he's going to run for public office, okay? And now the question is, what does the management team that he leaves behind do about, A, the trade war, B, this facility in Wisconsin, and a host of other things that they're faced with, like this declining demand from Apple for iPhones, and they were also a large supplier for Huawei, right? So there are a lot of pieces of this puzzle that have yet to be assembled, except Terry Goh ends up having a very different piece of it.
Willie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Willie Shih is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. You can read more about the complicated Foxconn story. Willie's recent piece at WisContext is Foxconn, Terry Goh, Donald Trump, Taiwan, and China. It's really complicated. Find that at WisContext.org. Coming up after the news, House Democrats are exploring new strategies for enforcing their subpoenas related to the Russia investigation. We'll find out more during our look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the state of invasive species here in Wisconsin, from giant hogweed to the Asian jumping worm, and what you can do to prevent their spread. First, we take our weekly look at some of the top news in national politics. House Democrats are exploring new ways to enforce their subpoenas of current and former Trump administration officials. An effort in the Capitol would raise the compensation level for members of Congress, and President Trump is pulling back from his threat to put new tariffs on Mexican imports after a reported commitment from Mexico to help limit immigration to the U.S. Lisa Mascaro is the chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having us.
Well, this week, the Democratic-controlled House approved new powers for committees aimed at enforcing subpoenas they've been issuing in the aftermath of the Mueller report. What would these powers do?
Yeah, absolutely. This was a big day here in the House yesterday in their pursuit of these investigations against President Trump. Your listeners might have been hearing how the administration is just really blocking the oversight committees from obtaining information. The Trump administration is blocking witnesses. Of course, the Attorney General has been asked to provide a full copy of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on the Trump Russia probe. Initially, he declined. And so amid what Democrats call this stonewalling and this blockade of their oversight abilities, they passed a resolution. Basically, it's a sort of internal rules change that allows the chairman of the committees to just go ahead and seek what is often called civil contempt. But basically, it just means to allow the chairman to go ahead and file lawsuits to force the compliance of the administration. For example, you know, well, let me just back up and say, you know, normally they would sort of hold someone in contempt and say, okay, we're going to file contempt procedures against you and hold you in criminal contempt. Well, you know, in the case of Attorney General Barr, you know, that just goes up to the Department of Justice, and the thinking is that, you know, the Justice Department then would not would basically not accept it, would just sort of reject it. And the Democrats have found that in filing legal action, taking these issues to courts, the courts are more willing to side with Congress. We've seen some initial moves by the courts to side with Congress as they try to get Trump's accounting firm to turn over some documents, as they seek other documents from Deutsche Bank in terms of the president's finances. Basically, this is a real standoff between the powers of the executive, the powers of the legislative, and then when you have the judicial branch come in, the courts have tended in the past, we'll see how it goes, to side with the oversight ability of Congress. And so the Democrats are kind of banking on that, and they're kind of thinking rather than fight this stuff out with the administration, they'll just let the courts decide.
And another front in this now, we're just hearing the news going on this afternoon, has to do with the immigration question on the census. Congress, House Democrats want documentation on how the White House arrived at this question. We've seen some documents come out from a deceased Republican consultant on some of the thinking behind the immigration question on the census. What's the latest on that as this is going on today?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a hearing underway. I don't know if they've gaveled that shut. One of my colleagues is over there covering it. But, you know, it's, again, sort of the same situation where the House Oversight Committee is preparing to hold Attorney General Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt, and then they would presumably file, you know, these court challenges because the administration is withholding this evidence. The Attorney General sent word to Chairman Cummings that the president would be invoking executive privilege, which means, you know, basically hands off. We don't have to show you anything. And it was a pretty busy hearing over there today. A lot of members wanted to speak about this. And, you know, for the members of Congress, they really see this as, you know, an infringing on their role, that Congress has this Article I role to conduct oversight. And so they really say it's not just for this president and his actions, but for the future relations between Congress and the executive branch. Of course, if you're the president, you know, on the end of those subpoenas, you don't see it that way. You see it as an attack on the presidency, and that's why you see the Trump administration fighting these documents.
Speaking of standoffs between Congresses and presidents, the House Judiciary Committee brought former White House counsel and key Watergate figure from the Nixon era, John Dean, to testify on Monday. What came out of that?
Yeah, well, that was interesting. That's really the Democrats, you know, they sort of lost their star witness when Special Counsel Mueller really said, you know, in a public statement, 2 weeks ago now, that he wants his report to speak for himself, and he really does not want to come testify. They were really hoping he would, and they're still hoping to get him in here. So in the meantime, I think Democrats are feeling a bit frustrated that the American public maybe didn't fully read the Mueller report or doesn't understand all of what's in it. And so they thought by bringing in some other high-profile names, it might sort of focus attention. And in their minds, sort of who better than former White House counsel John Dean, who has a real parallel figure in the current Trump administration in former White House counsel Don McGahn, who they also want to hear from. People might remember John Dean, you know, testified before Congress in a way that was very pivotal in the Nixon era and in bringing down the Nixon presidency. And so they wanted to hear from him and the parallels that he saw. And of course, he served them up. He said, you know, the special counsel provided a roadmap for the Congress to investigate the president. And he called on his counterpart, the more recently former White House counsel, Don McGahn, to come testify. Of course, Mr. McGahn, through his lawyer, has said that he will not be testifying, that the White House has asked him not to. But, you know, in Mueller's report, McGahn is one of the most oft-cited figures. He is cited numerous times in the report because he was among those talking to the president and telling the president why some of the president's actions should not be taken. He was trying as the White House counsel to sort of warn the president, you know, as his counsel that, you know, if you do these actions, they could be seen as obstruction. And, you know, that then would be an impeachable offense. And so, of course, Democrats are very eager to hear from him. They want Mr. McGahn to lay that out, but they don't have Mr. McGahn. So they brought in Mr. Dean to make that case yesterday or Monday.
It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Lisa Mascaro is with us from the Associated Press, chief congressional correspondent there. We're turning now to President Trump pulling back from his threat to put new tariffs on Mexican imports after a reported commitment from Mexico to help limit immigration to the U.S. You can join in on this at 800-642-1234. Do you think this deal, if it comes to fruition, will make a difference on the immigration issue? Do you think the tactic of threatening tariffs is a good way to get our neighbors to do something? Are you worried about the impact of back-and-forth tariffs and uncertainty surrounding those between the U.S. and trading partners? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, we've got this tariff threat now withdrawn by the president and apparently a deal. What do we know about what the U.S. and Mexico are agreeing to?
Right. Well, this was a late-breaking story last week, and it's been sort of disputed ever since. So, of course, President Trump, I will just back up and say, is slightly tied to what we were just talking about, because the day after Robert Mueller came out and sort of reiterated the findings of his report, President Trump sort of took center stage and said he was going to slap these tariffs on Mexico as a way to force Mexico to the table over the issue of illegal immigration. What they then spent several days, 48 hours, I think, negotiating to try to end this standoff that really both countries said would be devastating to the economies. And Mexico, of course, is the U.S.'s number one trade partner. Everything from, you know, avocados and cucumbers to, I'm sure your folks there in Wisconsin know, you know, parts for different industrial components and products, industrial products. So big leverage there that the president was throwing on the table. What they ended up with in this announcement late Friday, you know, is a little bit of what has already been underway. I mean, there is a new commitment from Mexico to strengthen the southern border with Guatemala by providing, sending Mexican troops to the border to shore that up and prevent crossings. And then the Mexican government also agreed to process asylum claims, more asylum claims in that country so that Guatemalans passing through Mexico to the U.S. stop and then have some of their claims processed there so that they're not all coming straight into the U.S. They did not agree to a more broader asylum overhaul that the U.S. really wanted, which is basically to keep all Guatemalans and Salvadorans and Hondurans in as they come up in Mexico and not letting them come to the border with the U.S. And the Mexican government did not agree with that. Now, of course, the president, when some of those headlines came out that said, well, you know, the deal wasn't really so big, made some statements saying, oh, there's more to come, and we actually do have a better deal. And that's sort of been the last day or so, a kind of back and forth between the Mexican negotiators from the Mexican government and the U.S. negotiators. Mexican government sort of saying, you know, no, we agreed to what we agreed to and not anything more. And Trump saying, no, there's more to come. So, you know, folks over at the White House beat have been sort of trying to sort that out and get a little more clarity. But, you know, the bottom line is, you know, a lot of folks are coming up from these countries. They're fleeing what advocates for immigrants and human rights advocates would say are sort of, you know, refugee-like conditions. There's drought conditions. There's security concerns in the Central American companies. There's the draw, of course, of the economy in the north. There really should be more of a refugee response, a humanitarian response to the situation at the border, and sort of trying to take this you know, economic response in trying to slap these tariffs. A lot of advocates who work with these groups say it's not the kind of thing, you know, that's going to change the situation on the ground. You know, the smugglers are sort of able to capitalize on the fears that the border will be closed and sort of, you know, ushering folks in, saying, look, you know, if you want to get in, you got to get in now. And, you know, so it's just sort of really created this crisis point at the border where we are seeing skyrocketing numbers. I think it was 140,000.
We're talking with Lisa Mascaro of the Associated Press about some of the top political news of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this reported deal between the U.S. and Mexico, the use of tariffs to try to get that deal? Are you worried about the effect of dueling tariffs and uncertainty over tariffs could have on the country, on you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our weekly conversation about the latest news in national politics. Lisa Mascaro is our guest, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Let's bring in a call now. Bob is with us in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
How you doing? I think one of the things that we do not really address very much are the consequences of certain short-term political actions, like what's going on in Mexico right now. If you were China, for example, would you trust anything that this government was doing? I mean, they don't keep their word. They make an agreement with Mexico, and then they turn around and change what they're doing. Of course, the problem could be easily or much better solved if we tripled the number of judges that we have to smooth up the system and reduce a lot of the bottlenecks which have been created artificially to create a problem which did not exist before.
Bob, thanks for the call. Two big issues there, Lisa. I want to touch on each of them. First of all, the idea that after signing the USMCA agreement, not ratified by the legislatures of the three countries yet, and then threatening these tariffs, Bob saying that raises a concern that other countries won't trust us as negotiators.
You know, it's a really notable point that the caller makes. The timing of the president's tariff announcement last week came at the same time, and I think within an hour or two, the same day for sure, that the president had just sent up to Congress some notification on the USMCA. The administration has been pressing Congress, pressing Speaker Pelosi and Leader Mitch McConnell to take up the USMCA for votes this summer. They were in negotiations, and then these tariffs hit. And again, it's right, it really does sort of jumble what had been a path and a narrative. And just to sort of broaden that out a little bit, you know, the president is working with China on tariffs that both countries have put on each other in the trade war with China. And, you know, it's heading to, you know, an economic summit where these are the kinds of issues that really do give pause and raise concerns. And it also, again, was a shift for the president. You know, often tariffs are used in these economic disputes, but here he was using tariffs in an unrelated, you know, dispute over immigration that really sort of is a new terrain for the way these tariffs are used in sort of trade negotiations. So, yeah, it raises a lot of questions on what kind of partner the United States is in this realm, and is going to leave some lingering questions.
Bob also mentioned a shortage of judges on the border to process claims of asylum. I've heard other people talk about this. Is this something, Lisa, that people have on the table? This needs to be part of our solution here?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been part of some of the immigration legislation that has been thrown around in Congress, in the House and Senate, the need to expand the number of immigration judges to more quickly process those claims at the border. But at the moment, I don't know if there's any. I know they had talked about that again a little bit during the shutdown when there was, another emphasis by the president on the border situation during the federal government shutdown at the start of this year. And I think there was a little bit of a resource there, but I don't believe it's up to the level that advocates were pushing for.
It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Lisa Mascaro is with us from the Associated Press. Want to move on to a couple other stories going on out there. A group of first responders to the September 11th attacks was in the Capitol yesterday lobbying for the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. Former TV host and comedian Jon Stewart has been involved in this cause. He gave an emotional speech to a House subcommittee where just the subcommittee showed up, not the whole committee, so a lot of empty seats. Here's a listen to Stewart.
This hearing should be flipped. These men and women should be up on that stage, and Congress should be down here answering their questions as to why this is so damn hard and takes so damn long. And why, no matter what they get, something's always pulled back and they got to come back.
So 18 years after the event, Stewart making an emotional case for first responders in the 9/11 attacks, Lisa.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my colleagues was at that hearing yesterday, and they had posted at AP News, at the AP News site, the story, and it was very emotional. And, you know, this is a fund that needs to be, that Congress needs to address and continue making sure it's funded. Every few years this comes up, and, it's lagging again this year, and they've, like so much of the fiscal fights up here, you know, they push it to the deadline, right? They push it to the last minute, and there's often a standoff because they're trying to bring in lots of other extraneous issues and real people, in this case, the 9/11 responders, you know, get lost in the shuffle.
What do we hear from members of Congress on that subcommittee in response?
I will say in somewhat of a defense, I guess you would say, you know, members come and go from these hearings. You know, they just like people might tune into C-SPAN and watch the floor proceedings. You know, it's not like they're all sitting there. They're moving around constantly during the day. They're in and out of the hearings, in and out of the floor. They're not always sitting there at all, listening to one another, listening to the witnesses and the testimony. You can certainly say it's a criticism of Congress and the way it works, but it is the way it works. And I think, a number of members would probably have, would try to defend themselves that way yesterday. I think they do think that this 9/11 bill will get passed and the funding will continue for that fund. But, you know, again, it's a matter of time, and having someone high profile like John Stewart come in is certainly going to shed a light and maybe get things moving a little bit.
In our last couple of minutes, some members of Congress are pushing to approve a cost of living increase for mm-hmm. congressional salaries. Some members of both parties on this. Where is that now?
Yeah, so that was supposed to come for a vote this week and got shelved for now because, as you might imagine, there's a lot of controversy around that. Lawmakers receive $174,000 a year, you know, to be in Congress. It's a lot of money for a lot of folks. But the lawmakers will tell you it's also not a lot of money when you're trying to sort of support two households, one here and one back in your home district. A lot of members of Congress are newer members. People who still have college debt, people with young families, and they say, look, you know, we don't want Congress to be just for the wealthy. But as you can imagine, a pay raise is not exactly the kind of thing voters want to hear about, especially when many voters, you know, are struggling themselves. So that bill is shelved for now. Part of the problem is that this is the kind of thing that the two parties need to kind of hold hands and jump. You need Republicans and Democrats to come together so that one side can't blame the other for, you know, getting a pay raise. They thought they had a sort of bipartisan agreement, Democrats and Republicans, but then the Democratic leadership said that the Republican leaders were unable to sort of produce their end of the votes. And there is some truth to that. You can sort of see how that happened. So they shelved it for now, and they're going to try to take another look at it maybe next week, maybe in later. So we'll see if they can rebuild that coalition. Again, you can probably sort of imagine the ads that will be run against these lawmakers. Yet at the same time, there's kind of a growing feeling, especially in a high-rent city like Washington, D.C., that, you know, it does limit who can sort of join Congress if you can't afford it, right? If you can't afford to do it. So it's a tough issue for them, and we'll see if they come back around at it.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, you bet. Pleasure to be here.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent at the Associated Press. She was with us for a look at some of the week's top news in national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. What do you hope to see out of a reported deal? The details are still to come between the United States and Mexico when it comes to cooperation on trying to slow the number of immigrants coming from Central America through Mexico and then claiming asylum in many cases at America's southern border. Let us know. Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can always email ideas at wpr.org. Here in Wisconsin, we might ask ourselves, is it possible to have too much cheese? Hold your answer for a moment. As reported in Japan Today, the Japanese branch of Domino's Pizza is releasing a new super cheesy pizza topped with 1 kilogram of cheese. What's a kilogram? First, some perspective. I did some poking around on standard amounts of cheese for chain restaurant pizzas. Seems like a lot of consensus that 8 or 9 ounces is about right for a 14-inch pizza. For Chicago-style deep dish, estimates vary. I'm seeing numbers like 16 ounces of cheese thrown around. Let's get back to that kilogram on the pizza in Japan now. Doing some quick maths, a kilogram-to-ounce converter tells me that 1 kilogram equals just over 35 ounces. So that's more than double the amount of cheese in a Chicago deep dish-style pizza, which is already pretty cheesy. So the conclusion, I say, is yes, it is possible to have too much cheese in a pizza. And as a bonus, I'll share with you a word of the day. The word is logy, L-O-G-Y, apparently is the official spelling. I use this word sometimes, and some people I know, they weren't familiar with it. I looked up a definition that works pretty well. Dull and heavy in motion or thought. Sluggish. As in, I felt logy after eating a pizza with 1 kilogram of cheese on it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.